Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
My apologies to Francis Hall for taking such a long time, but it's a bit like the opening remarks in a courtroom, Francis. I wanted to try and get it all out there. So welcome and a very good morning to you.
Welcome, Mike.
Thank you.
Hello, Mike.
Yeah. See, this mind-melding thing's easy when you know how. It's like Sage, you know, just get people to do what you want. I found myself quite happy yesterday with all of the developments. We can go into the reasoning and the whys and wherefores, but the first question I've got, really, for you, Francis, is what was it all about then? Can we conclude that, yes, of course there was a dangerous virus coming at us, and of course people suffered, and of course people lost loved ones, and of course people died, but the vast majority of the damage done to our society was done to very much elderly people and very much sick people, wasn't it?
I think we can say that it was a gigantic experiment, and in my view, it was the worst public policy decision in peacetime in modern times. I think we will look back on these 2 years. I hope that we will look back, if we have any sanity historically, on these 2 years and wonder what it was that led us to abandon all our pandemic plannings, all our experience of the progression of respiratory viruses, and most importantly of all of our understanding of the central importance of freedom and constitutional probity and democracy in governing ourselves.
Yes, because I think an awful lot of people, and I know that you and I are among them, were quite alarmed at the speed with which legislation was put together, that laws were passed, laws were enacted without even being discussed or debated in Parliament, that, you know, we need to find a place where we can say this must never be allowed to happen again in the way that it happened.
Yes, absolutely. And I was saying that from the beginning of March in 2020. And I identified in late March and in early April the fundamental problems with this, the monomania, the fact that the government was allowed to concentrate solely on one virus. It did, the fact that it had made no attempts to investigate and analyse the possible harms that this will cause, notwithstanding that it had already done that on a general basis rather than a specific basis in its pandemic plan, notwithstanding that the WHO's pandemic plan, and we need to remember this, in October 2019, recommended against far more moderate measures than this. Mm-hmm. It recommended against, for example, the isolation of even sick people by force. It recommended against, heavily recommended against, the isolation of contacts of sick people. Now, those were all eventually imposed, actually later, as it happens, than the lockdown. But they were far more moderate than the lockdown that we had, which was a Chinese communist experiment. Let us not forget, a Chinese communist experiment. It had no data behind it. It still has no data behind it. It was recommended against. It did not comply. If one looks at the evidence that we knew about in March 2020, the evidence that was being spoken about by Michael Levitt, a Nobel laureate, by Professor Yannoudis of Stanford University, one of the most cited scientists in the world, were saying that the Diamond Princess, which was an experimental opportunity to observe the infection fatality rate of this virus and the age stratification of this virus, showed, as you said correctly, that only very elderly people were mainly at risk. Obviously, everyone is at risk from any respiratory virus, including people who are normally well. Yeah. That's the case for the flu. That's even the case for the common cold. But the fact is that this was never the desperately dangerous pandemic on the Spanish flu scale that we were told about. We knew that from the start. The average age we now know is over the average age for death and mortality anyway. And we know, as it happens in the first year of the virus, those who are under 60 with no previous conditions, under 60 with no previous conditions, so serious enough to be mentioned on a death certificate, it was about 400 to 500 people. So, yes, totally disproportionate. But even if this was a much more serious pandemic, and the serious pandemics that were prepared for in the pandemic plans were estimates of 700,000 people dying. Even in those situations, it would not have been justified or proportionate to shut down society. And the reason for that is because First of all, those sort of lockdowns don't work. If you look at the comparative evidence and you look at the analysis, not by modelling, but by examples of countries around the world that locked down and that didn't lock down. Think, for example, on the one hand, Peru and Chile that had incredibly serious lockdowns, and Sweden, on the other hand, that didn't. You will see that in the long term, certainly, and even in some cases in the short term, they made very little difference to deaths overall. And deaths overall, of course, is the only really sensible metric of this. And the reality is that the long-term consequences of this will be with us, the long-term consequences on public health, the long-term consequences to our society, the long-term consequences on our children, who we have thrown to the wolves over the last 2 years, will be astronomical.
Yes.
And it is absolutely shameful that our political classes have allowed this to happen. It is disgraceful that our opposition has never asked the questions that they should have been asking. It is unconscionable that the media, by and large, with some honourable exceptions such as yourself, have failed to put these questions to them, to hold the government to account, to hold the health elites to account, to question why, as you said correctly, we have not had debates in Parliament about this. We have used an Act of Parliament that was never envisaged would be able to give the government powers to legislate like this and do what, as one Court of Appeal judge said in a case that I brought on behalf of others in 2020, were the most severe restrictions on liberty in this country perhaps ever. Mm. It is shameful. It's a disgrace. And we as a country should feel deeply ashamed of it.
The
only saving grace is that perhaps we are getting out of this insanity earlier than others.
Yes, I think that's a very important point to make. But equally, as I say, I'm not going to let them away with that. Because like you, Francis, I'm quite angry about what happened. You know, the idea that suddenly today, this very morning, you know, the 20th of January, Thursday, it's no longer dangerous for children to go to school without a mask on. And you think to yourself, well, why is it only dangerous if you're in a union? You know, because apparently if you're in a union, you've got a much higher chance of catching COVID. Therefore, you have to insist on people being much more cautious around you.
Well, in a union, you rightly say, because the teaching unions have been very much a part of the campaign for masks. In fact, Mike, it's actually that for the next week, it will still be dangerous in communal areas of
yes.
school. And only in a week's time will that be reduced. It's farcical, isn't it? And the trouble is that when the government does something, and this is a problem with the civil service, it's like a very large oil tanker. Mm. And frankly, it's like an oil tanker in the Suez Canal. It's incapable of turning around. And certainly, even when it gets back into the ocean, it's only capable of turning around incredibly slowly, however bad the mistakes were. And this was one of the serious problems of early 2020. Once this had been done, for matters of pride, and because the civil service will have set these rules, and because they set the targets, very cautious targets, but in fact very radical, because they were keeping this radical state of play in play for as long as possible, it became very difficult to disengage it. It became very difficult to move away from it, because it will have been such an admission of defeat, an admission of wrongdoing, effectively, which it was, of course.
Yes, exactly right. And as far as the law is concerned, Francis, your specific area of expertise, many people have pointed to cases of prosecution over the last couple of years, people who were fined £10,000 for having a party, people who were fined for sitting in a park with too close to somebody else, all of that. You know, do they have any sort of restitution possibility? Can you take a case to the government and say, hang on a minute, you guys were having parties in Downing Street all the time, and whenever I hear people saying, oh, why do you care about parties? You know, it's not about the parties, it's about the hypocrisy, and that is the point. Is there anywhere that these people can go legally to say, I want my money back?
Well, I mean, legally, these were regulations that they were imposed under the Public Health Act. Their lawfulness was challenged by Simon Dolan. That's the case I mentioned earlier in which I was acting, and unsuccessfully. So they can't legally be overturned. But my view is that the government should say and should pass legislation to the effect that they are all cancelled. All fixed penalty notices and all convictions are cancelled, and all the fines and the fixed penalty notices are repaid. And I think that is the least this government can do, bearing in mind the hypocrisy that it has shown through those parties. As you say, the main point there is hypocrisy, but actually the fact that these rules, they never believed in them, they never thought that they were really necessary, and they realised the complete absurdity of not being able to have a gathering in a public place outside in May, in the thick of what was a very early summer, as we remember, in 2020. It was a preposterous rule and one that they had refused to remove. But the £10,000 fines were an astonishing abuse of power, an astonishing abuse of the provisions that under the Public Health Act that allowed them to impose this legislation, imposed in some cases on students. And they weren't actually, unlike, and the government, of course, misrepresented what they were. They were in agreement to pay a fine. Nobody had to pay it. Because you can refuse to pay a fixed penalty notice and require the state to prosecute you. And at that point, the court will decide. And in some cases, in fact, Kirsty Brimelow QC has tweeted about this. She brought one of these cases. The student was told, you have to pay £10,000, refused to do it, went to court, and he was eventually fined £200.
Well,
because once the court looked at the proportionality of the sentence, that's all he was required to pay. So that was an appalling abuse of power. And throughout, the other thing about this is that the government and the media those who have supported them and not challenged them have given the impression that guidance has been lost. So even though the law has gone far further than it should, the greater guidance, the even more restrictive guidance, has been given the impression that that is law, and it never was.
Yeah.
So, for example, the closure of schools was only ever a recommendation.
Right.
There were powers to close schools in law, and they were never used. And yet the government says schools must close their gates. And the same has been in play with, for example, you'll remember in mid-2020, when most of the restrictions went, in fact, you could legally meet with 30 people.
Yeah.
But the impression was given by the BBC, by the Times, by many other media commentators and the government that you had to keep to the guidance, and it was only guidance about households and bubbles and so on. That was an abuse of power, a very serious abuse of power.
Well, and even if you think back to all of the madness around hospitality, where, you know, one minute there was a curfew, the next minute everything was shut at 10 o'clock, and in the centre of London and other cities, there were hordes of people all partying in the street. And you kind of go, great idea, well done. And then they had this kind of the Scotch egg manoeuvre, where you could only sit in a pub if you were eating something, and it had to be something substantial. And we had, you know, you cannot legislate for this kind of madness. And they admitted later the curfews were all just made up. The rule of six was made up. They thought of a number and had a debate, believe it or not, in cabinet about whether it should be six or eight. And you're going, is that the most important thing you can talk about?
And they have consistently failed to provide evidence for these measures. When we've challenged them in court, when my clients have challenged them in court in the cases that I've been in, they come up with the routine explanation that any reduction in social interaction must, by definition, in decrease the risk of transmission. And they haven't cited any evidence to support that. And in fact, there's a good deal of evidence that these measures made no difference. Certainly masks. The best measure of masks is this. If a country introduced masks mandates in isolation of any other measures, you would expect to see a change in the rate of increase or decrease of cases. Mm. And in no country that has done that, have you seen that? So irrespective of whether masks may work in clinical circumstances, irrespective of their utility in surgery, and even that's questionable, the evidence out for the last 2 years from hundreds of millions and billions, in fact, of people across the world shows that they do not work as mandates.
Well, as to slightly bastardise a well-known phrase, even Dick Turpin wore a mask, but it wasn't to take us away from disease, it was to steal from us. But that's another story. We had a call yesterday from a man that we know well on this show, Freddie Scovell, who's a listener, but also a founding member of the Free Speech Union. He was chucked out of a dentist, a place he has been going for a long time, where he was a patient, a regular patient, where he lives, because he refused to put a mask on. They started demanding that he show them some kind of medical exemption. He eventually showed them that screen grab you can have from the NHS website, but they nevertheless still just chucked him out of the dental surgery and told him never to come back. Now, he said to me last night, well, what do I do now? Can I now go back and say, well, now they've lifted it, next week I can come in as a patient?
Well, they haven't established that he does not have an exemption. He normally would have no reason to explain and justify his exemption, and requiring him to explain it requires him to reveal private medical information, which is an intrusion on his privacy. If he has an exemption because he's disabled, and obviously I don't know that, if he had a disability that caused him to be exempt from mask wearing, then that would have been an act of at least indirect, if not direct, discrimination under the Employment Act. Now, obviously, I don't know the facts of that particular case, but that can come into play. And banning him, but in any event, as a matter of humanity, banning him from the surgery for good, for not complying with a measure that isn't absolute, that allows exemptions, when he said that he has an exemption, when they've no reason to believe that he's lying about that, is an extraordinary thing to do. And I mean, this is quite apart from the legal ramifications of that, it shows great inhumanity. And I'm afraid to say our health services have shown enormous inhumanity. There was an example of a nurse who said, well, it's outrageous that these parties were going on when I had to tell somebody that she couldn't see her father when he was dying,
right,
and that was for the greater good. No, it wasn't for the greater good.
No.
That was a disgraceful, inhuman, and evil thing to do by that nurse and by that hospital. They didn't have to do it.
No.
And if they were following orders, they shouldn't have been following them.
Exactly right. Like many of the restrictions that we've had to face over the last 2 years, they were not caused by COVID. They were caused by a government terrified of public opinion, terrified of making a mistake, and as a result of which, making too many mistakes to number. Just finally, because we've got to run, Francis, Boris Johnson, he thinks, obviously today, that he's got away with it. He thinks that by lifting all these restrictions, we'll all forget about his dreadful stewarding, not only of the last few weeks, but also of the Conservative kind of manifesto, if you like, and what he supposedly was going to be elected to do. What's your sort of analysis of what happens to him?
I respectfully disagreeing with you, perhaps, I rather think better the devil you know, at least for the moment. I'm very concerned about who could replace him. Very concerned indeed. Jeremy Hunt or Michael Gove would be execrable. They have behaved disgustingly over this.
Yeah.
Particularly Gove, he's been in power. But the court, so kind of things that Jeremy Hunt has called for have been disgraceful. I would be terrified at the risk of them coming into power. I don't know about Sunak and Truss, who are probably the front runners. They perhaps would be better. They certainly would be less disorganised than Boris Johnson. But I do wonder whether the fact that Boris Johnson is weak is a good thing, because at the moment, I'm not sure that we want strong leaders. If we had a good, strong leader with great integrity, intelligence and perspicacity, and I can think of one of them in the last 40 years, then that would be great. But unfortunately, we don't have her.
No, absolutely right. Well, I think you might go down in history, Francis, as the first person calling for weak leadership of the country. It might catch on. You could be right. Great to talk to you as ever. Thank you very much indeed. Francis Hall saying, better the devil you know. You might agree with him.